Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shops, the Spectator's political podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast and I'm today joined by Fraser Nelson and James Forsyth. So Fraser, the DUP have accused May of breaking her promises on the Irish border. Are they about to cause more problems for May, do you think?
Well, they're certainly threatening to. I mean, the irony is that the letter that Theresa May sent them was supposed to be reassuring them, saying, oh, the EU want to split Northern Ireland and the UK, I'm not going to let it happen. But they read into the small print of that, but that's exactly what she intended to do. Now, there are two very difficult questions about the deal Theresa May is about to get that she would rather not answer, not directly. One is the EU going to make any separate demand of Northern Ireland than it is in the rest of the UK? In other words, is it going to have a means of laying some kind of claim to Northern Ireland, and is she about to agree it? And the second is how difficult it will be to get out of her deal. Now, the DUP, you've got to hand it to them. They've got this, of course, you know, the clues in the name, they're unionists, they've got this laser-like focus on anything which might weaken the Northern Ireland from the rest of the UK. And I think Theresa May will have said, it's funny that on the day she went into Downing Street, she was saying, I'm a very passionate unionist. But I do think she's been on a bit of a learning curve as to what unionism means to those who are genuinely passionate about it, and how something that might not cause a practical problem will be a deal breaker for the DUP. And the other thing is how likely the DUP are to vote against her. Now, you might think, well, would the DUP cause that much trouble? Surely they know about Jeremy Corbyn and the IRA. Surely they would not do anything to hasten Corbyn going into number 10. But the thing one has to remember about the DUP is if they are seen by the people who elect them to allow any kind of dilution of the union, then they won't be elected again. So their jobs depend on safeguarding this. And I, for one, take them at their word.
I think the problem for Theresa May is her attempt at reassurance doesn't actually address what worries the DUP. Theresa May says, I will never allow this to happen. That's not what worries the DUP. The DUP worry that if this Northern Irish backstop is there underneath the UK backstop in the treaty, it might end up being triggered, not today, not tomorrow, but 5-10 years down the line when Theresa May is no longer Prime Minister. She can't bind the hands of her successors. And so what the DUP worry about is, if it is there, what you might get is a situation where the parliamentary arithmetic is different, the DUP don't hold the balance of power in Parliament, and a future Prime Minister might think, either for left-wing reasons to do with state aid or right-wing reasons to do with economic competitiveness,
or perhaps if they're Corbynite and they want a united Ireland.
Yeah, they might think, okay, right, we're going to do this for the UK, for Great Britain, and if that ends up with the Northern Irish backstop being triggered by the EU, so be it. That's what worries the DUP. And this is what went so wrong when the DUP went to see Michel Barnier, which is that Downing Street had done a good job of reassuring the DUP about what would happen today, tomorrow, next 18 months. Barnier then set out what would happen over 10, 20, 30 years as the UK and the EU diverged. And it's very telling, I think, that when Arlene Foster talks about a good deal, she talks about a good deal for her grandchildren, because that is the kind of time frame the DUP are thinking about. And, you know, Theresa May is pretty expert at political survival, but I don't think anyone expects her to still be Prime Minister when Arlene Foster's grandchildren are coming of age. And so these promises from Theresa May are only promises that bind Theresa May. They don't bind her successor. And for that reason, the DUP don't find them that reassuring.
James, the other story making headlines this morning is that the EU has demanded fishing rights in British water. Is this going to be another headache for me?
I think in number 10, that would have been a kind of head against desk moment, because fishing is a small part of the economy, but in the political terms, this is a totemic issue. For Scottish Tory MPs, they are rightly convinced that a lot of their success in Scotland at the last general election was down to the clear commitment to get out of a common fisheries policy. If they're not out of that by the time of either the next Holyrood election in 2021 or the next general election in 2022, the Scottish Tory revival will stall. For that reason, I think there's a genuine danger that the Scottish Tories end up voting against the withdrawal deal on that basis. That's what the kind of Ruth Davidson, David Mundell leaked letter to Theresa May was all about. And then to compound the problem, who is the minister in charge of fishing, the Secretary of State in charge of fishing? Michael Gove, one of the kind of key Brexit swing votes in the cabinet. You know, and for Michael Gove, the fishing issue is personal. Remember that his adopted father was an Aberdonian fish merchant whose business was essentially ruined by Britain joining the EEC as it then was, and the common fisheries policy. So I think this is very, very problematic. The most optimistic way you can think about it from Downing Street's point of view is that the EU are demanding this, because this is a card that they're prepared to throw away at the end of a negotiation, because they know that Theresa May has to have a win on something if she's to go and sell this deal to her parliament. And Theresa May can come back and say, you know, cod is safe, our fish is our fish now, and that's proof that Brexit means Brexit.
If you listen to the language that Theresa May will use in coming days and weeks when she describes Brexit, there's going to be a list. It's going to be farms, fisheries, the money, the borders. It's not going to be trade, because realistically we're not going to get any free trade deal under what she's about to negotiate with Brussels, because effectively we'll still be in the customs union. But she is including fish in her little list here. This isn't something which she will be prepared to throw away. Now, I hadn't actually thought about that until James mentioned it there, that we're into the stage of negotiations now where the EU think they've got pretty much what they want, but in order for Theresa May to sell this, she's going to need to have a fake victory over something, so they're going to ask for something we never really wanted. Now, perhaps we're going to see a few of these fake requests, but at the nub of it, there is a genuine deal which Theresa May will put to her cabinet, perhaps with a special meeting on Monday. And I think we could be, you know, we'll see, but we could be about 3 or 4 weeks away from seeing the final contours of a deal and these reindeer games finally brought to an end.
Sorry, Fraser, can you just clarify what a reindeer game is?
Okay, a reindeer game is some ridiculous kind of petty game played by a kind of clique or an elite where they have some strange ritual, like trying to say you want something you don't, trying to catch somebody else out for not saying exactly the right thing. The kind of activities which you get mightily tired of if they're being carried out for a pointless purpose. I imagine the derivation is from Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. I think there was a reference in that song to Rudolph being excluded from certain reindeer games which nobody else could work out, a bit like EU manoeuvrings.
The phrase, I mean, it's not all bad news, is it? Because the economy seems to be growing pretty fast. What do you think's going on there?
I think they're one of the most significant trends right now is the detachment between politics and economics. Our politics is a complete mess with no leadership, no gods and precious few heroes. The economy is doing strikingly well. We've got full employment, we've got constant indications, anecdotal indications, of an economy far stronger than the official predictions are telling us. And yet again, we've had better than expected economic data. We've had growth growing at the fastest rate for really quite some time on a quarterly basis. I think the British economy has been forecast to do very badly by a lot of people who have simply been discombobulated by Brexit. It's a funny thing about Brexit. Normal economic forecasters, and who would never dream of showing bias in Labour versus Conservative, show huge amounts of bias against Brexit. Now, this colours what they forecast the economy will do, because they've got models. Rubbish in means rubbish out. If you input lots of gloom into your model, you're going to get lots of gloom as a result. But it seems that gloom is not shared by shoppers, not shared by companies, not shared by consumers. And Britain overall is doing remarkably better than its political situation would suggest.
I think one of the fascinating things about these numbers is how much they're driven by consumer spending. And I think this is one of the things that the models find it hard to take into account, which is they think Brexit's coming and therefore consumers will tighten their belts, cut down on spending on anything but essential items. You know, the Q2 figures were explained by, that's the combination of the good weather, the World Cup, the royal wedding created a kind of feel-good factor, but that won't last. I think the thing is, because obviously a majority of people who voted in that referendum voted for Brexit, they don't view Brexit as an inherently bad thing. So as Brexit Day approaches, they don't think, I'm going to rein in my spending because I worry about what happens when Brexit happens, because they are more optimistic about it than economists are. I mean, that's part of the issue here. I mean, the kind of question in a way is there something with Brexit, you know, that changes the consumer mindset, you know, and, you know, would that change in a no-deal scenario and all that, all those questions. I think, though, that this strong economic growth, though, is it is a boon to the government because, again, the if you look at what happened in the budget, you know, the reason Philip Hammond could get away with that big spending increase on the NHS without any increases in personal taxation is because the tax receipts were so much better than expected. If that carries on, the Tories will find it a lot easier to end austerity than they otherwise would. You know, the most worrying figures in the budget, I thought, were the fact that in the OBR's growth projections, the UK economy doesn't hit 2% in any of those years. You know, if you could get back to the UK economy growing at around 2.5%, then suddenly politics begins to look very different. And I think the Tories have a much better chance of defeating Jeremy Corbyn. I think they're kind of one of the absolutely crucial things that the next election will be. Have you seen wage growth out for the last few years? If people feel that their wages are growing in real terms and they are better off than they were before, I think Corbynism becomes much, much less appealing.
We've just, of course, seen in the American elections that Donald Trump was insulated, I think, against public anger to a large degree by the economy. He didn't talk about much of the economy. He works out it doesn't make for a very interesting political conversation. But if people do feel better off, if they generally feel that economically their life is going in the right direction, that makes them a lot more predisposed to keep the current government. So you don't have to bang on about the efficacy of tax cuts in the way that Trump hasn't to enjoy the benefit of this. So if the Conservatives were a little bit more bold with the economic medicine, the economy, I suspect, would be even stronger. But right now, I think these figures are going to continue to surprise and the gloomsters will be continue to be dumbfounded.
And just finally, this Sunday is, of course, Remembrance Sunday. Fraser, how will you be marking it?
I'll be going down to my local cenotaph with my kids and my father-in-law. Now, he's Czech, and his wartime memory is very, very different to mine. It's funny, right now, you know, he's telling stories to my boys who are 8 and 10, and the kind of what they had to endure in the continent, I mean, not just during the war, but in the post-war years as well, was of a completely different scale than what we had to. Sure, we had rationing, but our cities were not decimated in the way that they were where my father-in-law was growing up. So it's quite nice that all of us are going to go down there together. And it's also, I think, wonderful that this is Britain's national day, in a way. We're not great ones for waving the flag and saying our country is better than anything else. But to be united in this moment of remembrance and thanksgiving is great. And I guess, you know, I suppose I do get a wee bit emotional about this. My dad used to work in the poppy factory in Edinburgh, so this has always been quite a big moment in my family. But I guess one of the lessons I try to tell my boys is that people say man's born free, but man isn't born free. That freedom that we enjoy has to be defended and sometimes purchased by the lives of millions of people. And that's what happened a century ago. That's what happened 70 years ago. And that's what we're going to be remembering on Sunday.
I think the thing about Remembrance Sunday is how it reminds you of the 100th anniversary, how close together the two world wars were. That, you know, there is only 21 years between World War I ending and World War II starting. And it is that generational cost, you know, that daughters who grew up without fathers because they died in the trenches in World War I then saw that their own husbands die in World War II. I think it is the toll that those generations in that period of the 20th century took in such a kind of concentrated period of time. I think that is what is so stark about it. And I think in a way, it is a reminder that whatever travails and difficulties are and challenges our generation faces, we don't face anywhere near the same, we aren't faced with the same historical challenges that those generations have. And, you know, and we would not live in the society that we live in today if it was not for those people and their sacrifice and their courage.
Thank you, Fraser and James. And just a reminder that if you'd like to try The Spectator, you can get a month's free subscription if you go to spectator.co.uk/trial. Thanks for listening.